This is the Management 291 podcast, Surviving Organizational Behavior, produced by governanceproject.org.
Hello, Michael.
Hi, Anthony.
How are you today?
Not too bad.
Yeah? You had a good week?
So far. It's only Wednesday, though, so who knows what's in store for the rest of the week.
Today, we're going to talk about chapters 9 and 10 of the book, which are the chapters about individual diversity and about team culture. So we're both individuals. We're both people who have been inserted into team cultures, but we're expats as well. We have effectively come from our background cultures, background environments, and we have moved into foreign climes and cultures and gone into organizations that don't necessarily share our background and experiences. How have you found that?
It's definitely been a challenging part of my career. I think at the beginning, as an expat, when I first arrived in Luxembourg, I spent most of my time trying to figure out the people around me. What I probably didn't realize is they were also trying to figure me out too. Mm-hmm. I was probably so focused on just figuring out on how things work that I wasn't paying attention to that. And what you realize over time is no matter who you think you are, people have a certain view of you because of where you're coming from or the language you speak or the way in which you speak. And they draw conclusions about what you might expect and how you might be. It took me a little while to actually fully appreciate that these were the kinds of thoughts that were going through the minds of colleagues around me.
Interesting. I mean, were you perceived to be, because you are of Canadian Germanic background, were you perceived to be Canadian? North American? You speak with a North American accent, so the first impression one gets when one meets you is that you're North American.
Definitely, and most people, I think, would have pegged me for being a Canadian, and therefore assumed that I was loud and outgoing and confident and was up to speed on American TV and movies. That said, there are also people that I met in different contexts where when we were introduced, we were speaking German. My last name sounds German. Mm-hmm. And actually, it took them several months to even understand that there was a whole other part of me that that they were unaware of. And, mm-hmm. and they had sort of pegged me as being from a neighboring country. So very interesting how some of those relationships formed. And of course, it's only once you truly get to know people that you start to figure each other out.
Yeah. It's interesting because we're talking actually now about what we talked about last week, which is about stereotyping and prejudices. But just to complement what you just said there, I mean, I'm a Norwegian. There's a far lower general acceptance around what a typical Norwegian looks like or does or how he acts compared to a North American. So, in fact, I think a lot of people didn't actually apply a very significant stereotype on myself, except that somehow I was neutral. I was somehow somebody who didn't have strong opinions. That was the assumption, I think, from my perspective. And it's interesting because that has played into the way in which I have related to other people, colleagues, bosses, subordinates, and the organizations that I've worked in. So me fitting in as an individual has been very much influenced by the way in which people have reacted to my stereotype or lack of it.
And I have to confess, I've been to Norway once for a two-week hiking trip where I met almost no Norwegians. So, I think you're right, and I don't mean this in a derogatory sense towards Norway, but it is a smaller country. We're also in a smaller country here now, so most people just don't know what a typical Norwegian is like. And indeed, my sense is, well, he's from Norway, so that's probably like Swedish or Danish people. Probably center-left, probably fair, and if push comes to shove, probably adopts a neutral position. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think I have to confess that was probably my impression before even having a first discussion with you, knowing your background.
Mm-hmm. Which, all of these things, of course, play into the way in which you're able to fit in, right? The kind of role that... Because the way we're expected to behave does influence the way in which we have to behave in an organization, unless we want to shock people by being counter-stereotypical.
Exactly. And in a large organization, it's usually not a good idea to shock. from a career perspective.
That's true. So when we talk about individuals, we just mentioned the fact that we are expats. We are therefore very different from the environment in which we go into. But there are very many organizations and groupings where people are extremely homogeneous. And people are exactly the same, aren't they?
Yeah. In Luxembourg, things are, I think, quite dynamic. But certainly having worked in other locations, it can be very homogeneous from a cultural perspective, but also from other perspectives, background, upbringing, family, religion, etc. So it gets quite interesting when you get into an environment like Luxembourg where it's really quite a mixed bag in terms of, mm-hmm. of who you're getting. It also varies quite a bit, even in Luxembourg, from company to company. Some companies have an extremely diverse staff coming from 20, 30 different countries. Other companies of equal size may have, you know, mostly French people working in them, for example. Mm-hmm. So it depends very much on the individual company and the sector.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I have found is that the more, let's say, homogeneous or undiverse the organization is, the more dominant is the ethos of we do things the way we've always done things around here. In companies that have more diverse employees, you have the potential for a greater, broader discussion as to how we do things. But very often as well, the fact that everyone is so different, very often the company culture or the organizational culture is such that it actually forces people into a certain framework of expected behavior. The individual differences that we all have doesn't come out all that naturally because we're so pressured by the groupings into which the expected behaviors that we go into.
And that doesn't mean that in diverse workplaces there's a sort of atmosphere of constantly challenging every proposal. It just means that people react completely differently when faced with a business decision to be taken. You know, a really simple example, a customer might send in a complaint by email. You may have as a very natural reaction to take that customer's email, review the facts, and prepare a draft reply. Mm-hmm. When you're working in a more diverse environment, you may be sitting next to a colleague who says, my goodness, we need to pick up the phone and immediately call this client. And those are just two very different ways of approaching a simple problem like that. Mm-hmm. And it does challenge the first person's thinking, well, okay, I wouldn't have picked up the phone, but maybe that does make sense. Or no, I know this client better, and picking up the phone now would irritate her.
Mm-hmm. Having an organization where most people come from a similar background does set down expected norms that people, I suppose, are expected to comply with. But as you just mentioned, people react in different ways, which comes down to the fact that some people are extroverts, some people are introvert, some people are more... they worry more. Some people are calmer. Some people are very charming. Other people are rather abrupt and come across as being, you know, perhaps until you get to know them better, maybe rather unpleasant. All of these things are diversity, but how does this impact the way in which people work together?
Well, it impacts it. That's for sure. And you know, generally, we applaud diversity and encourage diversity, and I absolutely do those things. But it's important to recognize that as soon as you introduce diversity into the mix, well, there are going to be different opinions on how to deal with things, and there are going to be clashes. Sometimes those clashes are going to have positive effects. Other times, those clashes are going to really be a drain on productivity or even team morale. You know, take the example of, from a cultural perspective, some cultures where being more abrupt, or one would even maybe say rude, is entirely acceptable in a normal form of business communication. That may not work with other colleagues. So that's going to create a natural conflict. I think the challenge as a manager is, how do you harness that conflict so that it's creating positive energy for your team as opposed to being a drag?
Mm-hmm. We've both been effectively, we've worked in risk management type functions. You in law, legal department, and myself in a compliance department. I would put you as more extrovert than I am. Does that give us a handicap or give us an opportunity that to be extrovert or to be introvert? Is one better than the other?
I think they both have their pros and cons. And if you look at risk management roles, typically, I think the profile of someone who works in those roles is someone who's more conservative, someone who's maybe more introverted. The disadvantage of that is you're potentially perceived as weak or overly cautious by maybe the more aggressive business unit. On the other hand, in my own experience, being branded as potentially extroverted means that people know they need to consult you because you're playing a risk management role, but they also know that you may actually stand up to them, and that might be a deterrent for them to contact you in the first place, which is really not the mission. So I think my message is, you know, whatever your trait is, you've got to know what the potential traps are that are associated with that.
Yeah, and I would agree with that, because I'm one of my favorite mantras is to say that there's no such thing as a strength or a weakness. It's only two different sides of the same coin. In some situations, a trait is a benefit to the way in which you can execute that function, and in another situation, it can be to the detriment of the function.
So then that leads us to the question, these personality traits that we have, you know, are we built that way, or do we acquire these things along the way?
Well, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think you can look at many different studies, and I have looked at many different studies, and in fact, I would say that in terms of, are we genetically engineered to be who we are, or are we influenced by the environment? 60% or 30%, you can get very detailed studies that will argue one or the other. So I think the only conclusion you can draw from these things is to say that, well, there is some genetic influence in the way that we act and behave. And in a sense, that's quite logical. If we have some, let's say, basic instinct about fight or flight, it wouldn't be strange if that was somehow embedded into us instinctively, how to react in the first instance. And then, of course, it's a question how you're nurtured, how you nurture that kind of trait over time, and how you're taught to control it or to use it, which then changes the way and modifies the way in which you behave.
And I think it's important to remember that by the time sort of someone in their early 20s hits the corporate workforce, you know, they come with whatever predefined traits they come with, plus, you know, a solid 20 years of experience already, having been taught and already lived as part of a community. So there's already quite a bit of what I'll call baggage, which is attached to a new joiner in the workforce in their early 20s.
Mm-hmm. To what extent do you believe that the nurture, your upbringing, the education you get, encouragement you get from your parents, your experience at school actually forms your self-perception and therefore influences your behaviors?
I think it potentially seriously impacts your behaviors and your own self-perception. I think it's also possible that for certain individuals, that impact is lower depending on the experience they've had. That said, I don't think it's something that's fixed or set in stone. There can be people who have a particular experience during their childhood or their upbringing and really come with a certain set of personal characteristics, values, background, but can then have very different experiences which change those things. So I don't think we should ever exclude the possibility that people certainly evolve in terms of their own diversity as they progress and as they have new experiences. I'm convinced of that fact.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that, because we can have a self-perception, right? We can believe that we are, let's just say, we believe we are the best. But even if you are the best, that might not necessarily come out if you're not stereotypically viewed as being the one who should be the best. I'm thinking now about gender, for example, the gender discussion. Women, famously, are thought to be subject to the glass ceiling. Does that impact the way, do you think, people behave and their performance at work?
I think it certainly does. It impacts the way that the particular individual may perform. It also impacts how others around that individual interact with that person. Each person is different. There may very well be people who are able to go beyond that and understand the self-perception and take actions to continue to advance their career. But indeed, there may be cases where that self-perception is almost career limiting. So being aware of the perception of you by others, being aware of your own self-perception is really critical to then, you know, of course, understanding what you should be doing or what mm-hmm. you should not be doing.
Yeah.
And there probably are moments in your career where you get a reality check. The question is, when you get that reality check, when someone doesn't give you a promotion or something doesn't go the way you thought it should or you thought would be fair, do you recognize in that moment why that's happening? Do you recognize why that decision has been taken and what maybe you should have done differently or could have done differently? Do you understand the background? So there are these opportunities to try and adjust your own self-perception as you move along through your career.
Yeah, you mentioned it. I just want to accentuate it. I think it's absolutely essential that all of us as individuals, we understand who we are. I think the more that we have a self-understanding rather than a self-perception, if you can see the difference, where we actually know what our traits are and we know how we react to situations, and we also have our antennae out to understand and read how other people are reacting to us, that is the only and best way to really manage your own situation and relationships at work. It's not just the male-female question, it's also a question and a serious problem for African-Americans, for example, in the US, for other ethnic minorities, and also for the LGBT community. And this is probably at the heart of why so many large companies now are really running serious inclusiveness programs, some more serious than others, to try and create an environment in which all of these people who, for some reason, for one reason or another, would consider themselves to be disadvantaged and probably best served by keeping a low profile, to let them get comfortable and get the confidence to be able to come out and express their creativity. We can just imagine that when people are trying to keep a low profile, not to raise their voice, not to contribute too much to draw attention to themselves, how much of the creativity and abilities of those individuals that the organization can't capture. And that's why, from an HR perspective, it's really, really important. If we want to get the best out of our employees and the best out of diversity, we have to create an environment where people welcome individual diversity rather than try and put everybody into the same mold and have everybody act in exactly the same way.
And we've really only hit the tip of the iceberg in terms of diversity. You know, we've started with race, gender, ethnicity, religion, background, but this really is just the tip of the iceberg. These are the easily identifiable traits that have sort of bubbled to the top, and we seem to be doing something about it. But there are really all kinds of other aspects of our employees that we're probably not paying attention to in the way that we should. And so I don't mean to minimize what I'll call the mainstream diversity issues, but we're tackling those. But there are a whole host of other aspects to be considered here.
So I think from what we've been discussing, you can have an organization which is fairly homogenous, but even so, there'll be a lot of diversity in the personalities of individuals who work and the backgrounds and the experience that people bring, even, you know, where we perceive something to be pretty similar. How does this all play into the creation of a good team? Do we try and get a good team and a good team culture by having everybody thinking and acting alike, or do we try to profile people in a more specific way, in a more diverse way, to create the ideal team?
I think it's worth recognizing that usually you don't have the luxury of deciding who's on your team. From time to time, you do get the luxury where someone says to you, we'd like you to build a new team and go off and find some people. But usually you've got to work with the people you've got. Mm-hmm. And work with the people you've got, what does that mean? Well, that That might mean the people in your team, the people who formally report to you. But think about all of the other different teams that you're a part of in your company on a daily basis. You may be involved in a particular project which includes people from various departments. Your team might include external people to your company, service providers, other people you need to collaborate with. So you basically move through your day to different constellations of people, and these are all teams. And of course, each of these teams have a different makeup. The first step really is trying to understand what that makeup is, and appreciating that actually every team is different. And that seems like a bit of a cheap thing to say, but the fact is, when you're busy, you move from one thing to the next. You might have, you know, three meetings in the morning, and you'll be dealing with three different sets of people, all with different characteristics. It's easy to forget to have that reflex to say, you know, I'm now part of a new team here now between 10 o'clock and 11 o'clock in the morning. How do I, you know, how am I perceived in this team? What is my assessment of the people in this team, and how is that affecting my judgment? So it's really important to be aware of that throughout the day.
That's a very interesting point. I mean, if you're going to put together a team, you have to work with what you get. You're absolutely right. That's most of the time. If it's very long term, for example, you're building a team for your department over a 5-year period, you can recruit and you can think about it and have a long-term strategy around it. But very often, as you say, it's suddenly you're working together with a different department. They say, oh, X, Y, or Z is available to help with this project, etc. But that's when you then have to get into a discussion as to what exactly is required from the team members as a package, and who can come in and fulfill the various tasks or roles that need to be performed within that project group. And then the question is, does a team need a strong leader, or does it need a facilitative leader? In other words, a leader who basically is one of the guys who basically somehow diplomatically tries to get everybody to work together smoothly.
Well, in a sort of resource-crunched world, I think a leader is failing unless he or she is able to make all members of the team function really at 100%. That to me has got to be the leader's goal, is to ensure that you're getting maximum output, creativity, energy from everyone in the team. And so whether you do that using a sort of more top-down approach, or whether you do that by creating a forum and helping people interact with each other, I am indifferent. But I think you have to, as a leader, recognize that you've got these elements in your team, and they're all there to help you. It's your job to make that come together and to get all of that positive contribution to come out of the team.
Mm-hmm. And I think it depends very much on what in fact is the purpose for the formation of the team. If it's to put together one of the more complex items from IKEA furniture or something, where there are very clear instructions, or there should be clear instructions as to how to do it, maybe what you need is a very directive kind of leadership model where you're just saying, okay, you're doing this, you're doing that, and it doesn't really matter. You're not looking for creativity. But if you're looking for creativity, let's come up with a new solution which we haven't thought of. Let's do some out-of-the-box thinking around this problem, come up with something completely new. Then you need to be much less directive. And perhaps the role of the leader in that position is simply to ensure that people understand that they all have strengths, they all have something that they're bringing to the table, and everyone is aware of it, and everyone respects each other in that environment.
And the critical role of the leader there is as well to help team members understand, you know, their own biases, perceptions of others in the team. What one person sees as a strength, another may see as a weakness, and really it's for the leader to arbitrate those and to help each person in the team understand what everyone's bringing to the table.
Yeah.
You know, there can be conflict. Not all conflict is good, and there the leader has a role to play.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I think there's something called the three C's of teams, which means you need to make sure that every team member is committed to the purpose of the project team. Everyone has to have a collaborative attitude, and you've got to have the necessary competence around the table. And I guess that means you also have to have recognition by all the team members of who has what competencies. These three C's are really at the base. Once you've got those in place, hopefully a good team will learn to trust each other and rely on each other that what they say they're going to do, they're going to do it and get it done.
That's right. And the sports team analogy is really helpful here. I mean, if you're on an athletics team, commitment, collaboration, and competence or skill, you can't have someone in the team who decides that they're not going to subscribe to one of these key elements. Otherwise, it doesn't work. And it's exactly the same in our professional environment.
Yeah.
So maybe just as we're reaching the end of today's chat, maybe it's time to assess our teamwork.
Uh-oh. Yeah. No, I think, well, I'm happy with it, Michael. I don't know. Are you happy with it?
So far, so good.
Okay.
I think we probably, if we take the three C's in reverse order, competence, I think we each have sort of similar areas of competence, but we bring different technical, specializations to the table. I think we each recognize each other's competence, so mm-hmm. so that doesn't tend to cause too much friction.
And I think it's interesting because I think we do actually have similar competencies. I mean, we're both big enthusiasts about governance, about risk management, about ethics and so forth, but our motivations are just slightly different. We're slightly different in age. You're a slightly different stage in your career than I am, which means that my thinking is less tied to the development of any one particular organization. You are working for an organization right now, so that obviously will influence your thinking, I think. But also, we bring a different emphasis to the subject. So we get diversity, even though we have similar competencies and similar interests. The intensity of that interest will change and vary according to each subject. And then we've got collaboration. I think that seems to work relatively well. It's been pretty painless, and I've enjoyed very much having you as co-professor and working with you at the university. So that's been pretty good.
And I think both of us value that collaboration, and that definitely comes out in our discussions. We each appreciate that we have our own schedules and our own commitments and pressures, but there's a bit of a give and take there, and that's also part of functioning as a team.
Yeah, and I think we can conclude that basically, if we did not have a similar level of commitment and understanding as to what we're trying to achieve, if we weren't able to work together as smoothly as we do, and we weren't competent enough to discuss these issues, it wouldn't work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's good, because when we're talking about motivation and understanding as to what we're committed to and engagement, that will lead us on to next week's discussion.
That's great. See you next week.
Very good. Look forward to it.
That was the Management 291 podcast with Michael Schweiger and Anthony Smith-Meyer. Music by Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com. Thank you for listening.